that the number of Orishin that exist now is a number that does not grow. How they ever came to any number at all remains a mystery, one that none of the Orishin seem ready or able to answer. They were a pacifistic species once, agricultural mostly. Their world, Orish, was lush. Though Mon has never been there, she's walked through virtual holoscapes serving as an archival memory of that world, and found their planet to be a pastoral haven. At least until the Empire came. The Empire enslaved the Orishin. They worked the inhabitants hard for food, strip-mined the surface, drained the soil of nutrients. Then one day, the Orishin fought back. Over years, they'd hoarded bits of pesticide and fertilizer. They made a bomb, and they used it. That bomb destroyed those Imperials on Orish. It also poisoned the world, the ground, the water, even the atmosphere. Now few Orishin are left, thousands at best, no longer living on their world but above it, in a skeletal framework of tubes and stations. Tolwar Wartol is one of those survivors. She's read his memoir. He was a chemist once, and helped to make the chemical weapon that would destroy their world. In the book, he tells stories of the beauty of his world ruined, how the bodies clogged the streams, how they had to build massive tombs for those of their own they lost. And he also tells the story about the day that the Empire fled. They abandoned Orish and its people because what was once of value to them had been ruined. Wartol described that day as a triumph and proof of what must be done to combat the Empire. Wartol brings that survivor spirit to his politics. He offers the galaxy a well-earned assurance that he, above others, knows what sacrifice is and what must be done to preserve life and freedom. He is charismatic. He is full of anger. His anger is righteous, but is it right? Either way, he commands every Holonet news cycle, attacking Mon at each turn. As he should, she supposes, if he really wants to win. But she wants to win, too. "I intend to continue on as Chancellor," Mon says. "But I'm not yet sure how we win. So, advisor, advise me. Let's hear it. How do we win the election? How do I convince the Senate to vote for me over him?"
Oxy takes a seat on the other side of the desk. She purses her lips, humming as she thinks out loud.
"You're ostensibly doing the right things already. You're apportioning resources and infrastructure for worlds afflicted by the Empire, and afflicted by the vacuum of leadership now that the Empire has been pushed back. You've kept the military strong despite the loss of Imperial threat, but you've also made sure that the New Republic military isn't too strong, so it doesn't look like you're trying to enforce your will on a weakened galaxy. Kashyyyk... Kashyyyk..."
Mon says that word with the weight of a heavy stone dropped into clear, still waters.
"Kashyyyk is complicated. The Senate resisted us getting involved there, and then Leia went and got us involved anyway. Given our friendship, it looks like you approve the clandestine action. And because Leia's efforts there were a success, I cannot disavow."
Oxy thrusts up a finger, as if testing the wind for its direction.
"Do not be so quick to disavow. Yes, some within the Senate have not good to say about that. But it did bump your approval rating. No small thing after Liberation Day. Kashyyyk was a win for us. A win earned by defying the will of the Senate. Leadership can mean defiance. Palpatine was defiant. So was Leia. And you're not Palpatine."
Leia. Another complication. It's political, yes. Her friend went against her explicitly. But of course, that is a blade that cuts both ways, isn't it? Mon defied her, too. She couldn't get it done with Kashyyyk. Couldn't convince the Senate. Then again, did she really try? She was hoping to handle the newly formed Senate gently, gingerly, so as not to feel like she was pushing or pulling them. But perhaps leadership required a bit more of Leia's brand of defiance. Leia, a political complication, but also an emotional one. They betrayed each other. A little, at least. It hurts Mon's heart.
Oxy says,
"We need to find an angle for you. Crime is an angle. The Empire goes away, and crime is up in its wake. The syndicates are struggling for dominance. We could go heavy on crime. Become the law and order candidate without leaning too autocratic. Or if we played up the Kashyyyk angle with Leia by your side again."
And then, as if on cue, one of the Chancellor's protocol droids pops its head in through the door. Metal face coated in white matte enamel. The droid, RK-77, chimes in a crisp Chandrillan accent.
"Chancellor, you have an urgent meeting request."
"Of course. Everyone's desires are always urgent, aren't they? From whom?"
"Princess Leia Organa, of the Alderaan sector."
"Her ears must be burning."
Mon asks,
"Did she say what it was regarding?"
"No, Chancellor. Only that it was of the utmost importance. She said to tell you it was a code K-10.
That was a Rebel Alliance code. Disengage and regroup. Last time they used that code, it was the signal that came out of Hoth when the Empire attacked their base.
Send a reply. Tell her I'm on my way."
Chapter 7. Temin sits on a cushioned bench. Sinjir paces in front of him.
"She'll be fine," Sinjir is saying to Temin. "Your mother has Jazz with her. They're both tough. Tougher than you and me put together, boy. You needn't worry about her. They'll be better than fine. You watch. The two of them will tear the Empire out of the sky with their bare hands. I'm not worried. And you should not be worried either."
Sinjir is lying. The boy can tell that much. Usually the ex-Imperial keeps all his emotions neatly vacuum-sealed behind a cool, disdainful veneer. But that veneer is cracked. Worry bleeds out. A tremor of fear hums in his every word, each syllable like a nerve freshly plucked. The two of them sit in a room. Only now does Temin even realize what this room is. It's a nursery, or the start of one. He's been staring at a round, white, egg-like orb against the far wall now for the better part of 10 minutes, not even seeing it. More like seeing through it. But then it clicks that he's looking at an infancy cradle. That cradle will serve as a bubble of safety for the coming child. Above it is a holoport, ready to project, well, he guesses a mobile, or other soothing images and sounds. An ocean lapping at the shore, or rain on a jungle canopy. Princess Leia's baby, he knows, will have a good life. The best life. A family kept together. A father and mother who love him. Temin doesn't remember being a baby, but he remembers seeing his old crib in storage after Dad was captured and Mom left for the rebellion. His cradle was in the old, unfancy Akivan style. Mesh sides, dark wood, curved slats at the bottom so it could rock back and forth. Netting over the top, too, to keep out the waves of yaya flies that came after every storm. No yaya flies here. No old, creaky crib. And no mother either. No Nora.
"We have to go back for her,"
he says through gritted teeth. It's already been 8 hours. 8 hours since Mom, Jazz, and Bones jettisoned themselves toward Jakku. 8 hours since the Moth jumped into hyperspace, narrowly avoiding death by torpedo. Anything could happen in 8 hours. The Empire may have shot them down, or found and captured them. Or maybe they died on impact. Temin bites his lip. He tastes blood.
We will,
Sinjir says.
We'll find a way.
But just as Temin hears worry in his friend's voice, he also hears doubt. He's about to call that out when the door opens. A familiar face shows itself. Han Solo, Leia's husband, captain of the infamous Millennium Falcon. Not long ago, Leia hired the crew to find Solo. They found him, all right, and ended up helping him get back his co-pilot, Chewbacca, on Kashyyyk. Solo has a couple of fruits, one in each hand. He offers one to Sinjir, then tosses the other to Temin. The boy catches it, just barely.
Shogun fruit, Han says, looking uncomfortable. I bought a bunch, so it's fine. Eat them. I don't think Leia wants them.
Moments like this, moments of real emotion, seem to bother the smuggler. He's like Sinjir that way. Most of him seems to be hidden away behind a wall of blustery ego and cocky pride.
Two of you don't look so good. If you need something, I can get the droid to...
What I need is my mother back, Temin says, leaping to his feet. He gets in Solo's face. I need you to take us back to Jakku. Come on, let's go. We get the Falcon and we charge in there, cannons blazing.
Whoa, kid, whoa. Cool your heels. I'm lucky, but I'm not that lucky. We go barreling in there, we're dead. All of us. Won't be any good to your mom if the Falcon is our casket.
And what good is it if that planet becomes her tomb?
Han's mouth works like he's going to say something, but his brain can't figure out what.
I got a family coming, and there's a procedure here.
Procedure?
Temin laughs, but it isn't a happy sound.
Where was your love of procedure when you went off trying to save Kashyyyk? When you got Chewbacca captured? And last I checked, my mom and the rest of us were more than happy to spit in the eye of the New Republic when it came to doing what you wanted to do.
Solo screws his face up like he's about to be angry. Then he says, suddenly,
You want to do this? Fine. Han Solo pays his debts.
Helping you cost us a lot, and I don't think you appreciate...
Wait, what?
Temin blinks.
What did you just say?
Lowering his voice, Han answers.
I said you're not wrong. I owe you. And Leia's gonna kill me, but the Falcon's the fastest ship I know. And maybe, just maybe, if we hit that planet blockade hard, they won't even see us coming. I might be able to get us down to Jakku. We'll lose a couple of tail feathers along the way, but nothing a bundle of bonding tape won't fix. The Falcon's seen worse. If I could just get Chewie...
You're serious?
Kid, I don't joke around about this kind of stuff.
Temin's heart rises, then sinks just as fast.
You can't.
Nobody tells Han Solo what he can't do.
You're gonna be a father. I can't... You can't. A child needs his father, doesn't he?
A battle unfolds on Solo's face. A whole war. Like he knows what Temin's saying is true, but also like Solo knows who he is and what he does. And for better or for worse, this is what he wants to do.
Leia will understand. She's like me. She does what...
But whatever promise or plan Solo is poised to make, he loses the chance to say it when the door opens and Princess Leia comes into the room, flanked by the Chancellor. They enter in a way that both fills the space with their presence and steals the oxygen at the same time. Even a cocky smuggler like Solo seems smaller, humbled in their shadow. Senate guards threaten to come in as well, but the Chancellor stops them short with a stiff shake of her head.
No, we will be alone.
Han takes the initiative and steps out of the room, pushing the guards back. His hand touches Leia's as he leaves. A sweet, lingering grip. Temin remembers when his parents were like that. So long ago now. Mon Mothma closes the door as Han and the guards exit. The Chancellor's face is a strange thing. Temen can't decipher what's going on there. Is that fear in her eyes? But a tug of a smile.
"Hello, Temen Wexley,"
she says.
"You will forgive me if I cut right to the chase, but time is precious. I want to know what you saw above Jakku. Tell me what you told Leia."
Soon as they came off the Moth after landing on Chandrila, Leia was the first person they saw, and the only person, too. They went straight to her, because who else would they tell? The princess has been their patron through all of this. Their hunt for Sloane was off the books. Just like their hunt for Solo. Just like freeing Kashyyyk. He's not sure he's really supposed to be talking to the Chancellor about this stuff. Mon Mothma is important.
Her being here makes him feel very small.
Temen flashes a panicked glance to Sinjir, then to Leia. The ex-Imperial shrugs, and the princess gives a subtle nod, indicating tacit approval.
"The Empire is on Jakku," he says,
plain as he can make it.
"What does that mean?"
"I mean, there's a whole lot of ships there in orbit."
"How many? And what kind?"
"At least one Super Star Destroyer. A couple dozen Star Destroyers, too. And that's just what we could see. The far side of the planet may have had more. TIE fighters were everywhere, and..."
A knot forms in his throat. He swallows it.
"We got out, but my mother is still there. And my droid."
"Along with one of our crew," Sinjir interjects. "Jazamari, a bounty hunter. I like very few people, but I quite like her and Nora, so we want to go and get them back, if you please."
Under his breath, he says,
"Though we don't have to bring the droid back, necessarily." "Shut up, Sinjir. This situation is fraught,"
Mon Mothma says. Sinjir scoffs.
"Fraught? Yes, I bloody well imagine it is fraught. You've been looking for the Empire, haven't you?
Well,
ta-da! We did it. We found them. And as a reward, I'd like you to send all your little ships and all your precious troops in to blow them into cinders and dust while me and the boy here rescue our crew. Correction. Our family.
Your presence there, your mission, was unauthorized."
Leia steps in, her chin up, her eyes flashing.
"I already told you they were there on my authority."
"Your authority is not the Senate's authority,"
the Chancellor retorts.
"Be glad it isn't, because presently the Senate is too timid to authorize a handkerchief for a noisy sneeze. Kashyyyk, I'll remind you, was a success, and we did it without your help."
"Hunting down Grand Admiral Sloane is the purview of the New Republic, not an Alderaanian princess and her friends."
The tension between the two of them is like a tightening cable. But suddenly, the Chancellor puts some slack in it. She lets out a deep breath when she says,
"Oh, Leia, I'm sorry. You were right, and you're still right. Freeing the Wookiees was just the thing to do. And if the Empire is really there on this planet..."
"This is what we've been waiting for,"
Leia asserts. Her tone, too, becomes more conciliatory, as if she's pleading with the Chancellor.
"This may be it. The end of the war. I know that you don't condone military action for the sake of it, but it was military action that destroyed two of their battle stations. It was our military that freed Akiva and overtook Kuat. We have to take this seriously. If this is true, we have to attack."
"Wait,"
Temen says.
"Attack?"
All of him tenses. Images from the space above Jakku flash inside his head once again. TIE fighters swarming everywhere.
His innards gone cold. His blood gone hot. His mother rocketing away in an escape pod. If war comes to Jakku, she'll be even more vulnerable, even more in danger. War. That's what Sinjir meant. send all your little ships, all your precious troops. Oh no! But no one answers his question. His fear lies unassuaged.
The Chancellor nods to Leia.
Yes, but we have to do this right. We don't even know what this is yet. Why this planet? How much of a fight are we to expect? We want this to be the Empire's last stand, not ours.
Whatever we need to do, let us know, Leia says.
Sinjir adds,
Yes, we're ready.
The Chancellor stiffens. Gone is the slack in her cable. Once more, the cold, undeterred mask settles over her face.
Good. Stay ready. This will need to pass muster with the Senate. I cannot authorize an action so consequential without their approval. But after Liberation Day, I suspect they may be eager for a last taste of Imperial blood. Still, I must have data. I cannot take mere suspicions to them, or they'll bury me. That is the primary mission. Get the facts. In the meantime, tell no one. What we talked about here does not leave this room. Are we clear on that?
Everyone nods, except Temin. He stands there, shaking, his eyes wet. He wants to scream and yell and flail about. He wants to tell her, My mother is there, and you don't need any more facts than that. He wants to threaten her with, If you don't go and save my mom right now, I'll go out there and tell everyone. I'll scream it so they can hear me as far as the Outer Rim. But when the Chancellor points her gaze at him, it's like being pinned by a set of crosshairs. Reluctantly, he nods. Before exiting, Mon Mothma turns heel to toe with the precision of an old battle droid. Not Bones, who would more likely do a plié and kick the door down. Leia says,
We will get Nora back, Temin. I promise.
And then she's gone too. Once more, it's just Sinjir and Temin.
That's a promise she can't make, Temin says,
his voice quiet.
True, though I suspect she means it just the same.
We can't count on her to get it done. Never count on a political machine to operate efficiently. So we do it ourselves?
Sinjir claps a hand on the boy's shoulder.
We do it ourselves, and we call in our chip with Solo, too.
Thanks, Sinjir.
Don't thank me. I want them back as bad as you do. Now we just have to find a way to make it happen without, well, dying in the process.
Chapter 8 Night falls on Jakku. With the darkness comes the cold. It leeches the heat out of the air, the sand, the stone. In the distance, black shapes rise, shadows deeper than the dark of the sky, plateaus and buttes like carven anvils. It was Jazz's idea to head that direction. Not only would that get them out of the hellish heat of day, but she saw a flock of axe-beaked birds flying that way.
They're headed towards something,
Jazz said then.
Don't know what. Food, hopefully. A settlement, maybe. Anywhere is better than nowhere.
And so, once they pilfered the pod of all its limited goods, medkit, blaster, a handful of rations, they started walking. And walking. And walking some more. The sand is slippery beneath their feet. It's hard to find purchase, which works extra muscle groups. Every time the sand shifts or she steps on a stone slippery with scree, Nora's muscles tighten further. And by now, her legs feel as stretched out as the control belt on an old speeder. Worse, Nora feels sick. The sun sucked everything out of her, siphoning her life force away drop by bloody drop. Now, with night, the chill has crept under her skin and settled in those empty spaces like an infection. But still, they trudge along. To where, she doesn't know. To
To what end, she cannot say.
This was a mistake. Sloane is here. She knows that. She can feel that.
Not like she has the Force, but like it's something in the air, in the dust. Maybe she's just trying to convince herself that this is it. This is where it all ends.
But even if Sloane is here, then what? Nora is on a dead-end, bone-dust world.
The erstwhile Grand Admiral could be anywhere, in any direction. And Nora could spend the rest of her days wandering the burning dunes, managing to find nothing or no one but her own foolhardy demise. Perhaps the one advantage is that this is such a dead place, someone like Sloane would stand out. Now if only they could find someone to whom that matters. Someone with eyes to have seen Sloane in the first place. She's about to say something to Jazz, but the bounty hunter now faces her with wide eyes. A hard finger mashes against Nora's lips. The Zabrak warns, "Shh." Nora watches as the shape of Jazz, her shadow, her silhouette, gestures toward her ear, a sign to listen. So Nora listens. The few sounds of the planet crawl into her ear. The whisper of wind across the dunes. The distant ululation of some animal. The drum pulsing of her own heartbeat behind it all. But then, their ears pick up something else. A faint shudder and hiss, like the sand moving. It's off to Nora's right. And then again, to her left. The sounds come simultaneously, and they're getting closer. The noises stop as fast as they start. Once again, Nora and Jazz are left with the wind, the faraway beasts, the pounding of blood in their own ears. Nora thinks and is about to say, "We need to keep moving." She doesn't get that chance. It happens quickly, from both sides. The sand erupts around them. The spray stings against Nora's cheek, and she staggers back, her eyes burning. She swipes at her face, blinking back tears, and something crashes into her, roaring. Her shoulders hit the ground half a second before her tailbone. The wind is knocked out of her, leaving Nora gasping. Her attacker is on top of her, and as her vision clears, she wishes it hadn't. The face leering down at her is far from human. Big black eyes, an insectile mandibular mouth, leathery flesh. No, not a face. A helmet. A mask.
Sashika!
Her foe barks at her, words gurgled around a hissing ventilator. A fist slams into her middle. Anger blooms in its wake. Her adversary has his legs straddling her hips, but the ground beneath her shifts easily with the sand, and it takes little effort to wriggle free. She kicks out hard, pivoting her lower body as she does, and it gives her the opening she needs, crab walking backward as her foe paws for something in the sand. A weapon? A blade! Square at the top, bent in the middle, like a machete. The metal is dark, maybe rusted, though it's hard to tell. He roars again and brings the blade down against her legs, but she scissors them apart, and the blade is buried in the sand with a coughing cuff sound. Nora stabs out with her foot. Her heel connects with his ventilator, and it starts squealing. Plumes of steam, white as a ghost, come free of his mask as he claws at his face. Now, as he dances backward, Nora can see Jazz. Jazz has her own enemy to deal with. The bounty hunter is still standing and lashing out with a high kick. Her foe is bigger, heavier, with an upper torso like a handful of grain sacks strung together with heavy gauge chain. She connects with the kick, but it doesn't seem to faze him. The big monster bellows an incomprehensible cry, then catches Jazz in a hard swing of his meaty fist. The bounty hunter topples, limp and lifeless. No! Nora gets her legs under her and springs forward. She connects with his middle, tackling him, expecting her weight and momentum to knock him off balance. But the thug isn't going anywhere. He's like a pylon driven deep into the mantle. He doesn't budge. Worse, he laughs. A gross, mechanized chuckle erupts from his own ventilator, and both of his hands marry together into one hellacious mega-fist. He slams his hands down into the center of Nora's back. She hits ground once more. Air gone. Pain radiating. Blood in her mouth as her jaw snaps shut, teeth around the tip of her tongue. In the dark behind her eyes, she sees streaks of white. Someone grabs her ankle, turns her over. Her attacker is back. He adjusts something along the side of his head, and the jets of steam suddenly cease. The thick, sack-chested monster joins the other one. The two of them stand tall over her, talking, pointing.
Pawikoya!
The littler one says.
Yes.
The sack-chested monster says, agreeing, chuckling. Then the little one shakes and shudders. His chin lifts, and his head does this wobble on his neck. Nora's face is suddenly wet, as if misted. He hits the ground like a felled tree. Sackchest grunts in confusion. Then his head tilts hard to his shoulder. This time, Nora sees a faint red flash along with it, and the monstrous thug pivots on one heel and lands hard atop the other. We're saved, Nora thinks. Or rather, Nora hopes. She stays still, though, just in case. Jazz! She says in a loud whisper. Nearby, Jazz groans. Lights fill the air, bright and bold. Not from one direction, either, but from three, all on at the same time. And Nora has to cover her eyes, lest she go blind from it. Shadows emerge, light framing dark armor. The crackle of static as a voice broadcasts.
Don't move!
As the shadows close in, Nora hears the faint jostling of jointed armor and blaster rifles in gloved hands. It's a familiar sound that means one thing. Stormtroopers. The voice is quieter when it says,
"We found them! We found the rebels!"
From nearby, Jazz curses under her breath. Nora, though, smiles around her bloodied mouth. Because Stormtroopers means Empire, and Empire means Sloan. Chapter 9. Sloan kneels, blind and bound. The ratty ribbon across her eyes is filthy and rough. It feels like it's abrading the skin off her face. This whole planet is like that, though. Everything is coarse-grained sandpaper, wearing down first to muscle, then to bone, then to the marrow beneath, and soon only to whatever passes for a soul or a spirit. A ghost left to wander these dust-choked deadlands. Her wrists chafe, too. The rope binding them is raw and fibrous. At least they haven't sealed her mouth or her ears. What she hears, the pad, pad, pad of feet on stone. Not hers, but those who pull the cart in which she waits, drawing it deeper and deeper through the winding red cavern. The cart itself is old, stone fiber boards lashed together with braids of tendon, and not buoyed by hover planks or grav plates, but rather kept rolling by a pair of proper wheels. Wheels that clank and rattle as the cart is drawn over the hard, rust stone. What she says,
"We're almost there. The air is cooler down here."
What he says, "I hope so. Everything of mine is cramping up." Those are the words of her traveling companion, a man named Brenton Wexley. She found him stowing away in her ship when she barely managed to escape Chandrilla. Sloane was injured and drifting toward death, but he saved her life.
Sometimes she's surprised he's still with her. But his purpose is her purpose, too. Find Gellius Rax and end him. Rax, who stole her empire from her. Rax, who stuck a chip in this man's head and turned him into a killer. Vengeance drives the pair of them. It marries them, too, in a way. The oddest of couples, aren't they? She, the one-time Grand Admiral of the Empire, a title she cannot imagine matters anymore. And he, a former rebel spy turned programmed Imperial assassin. Neither of them wants to be here. But this is where they are. And they've been here for months. Jakku is a decrepit wasteland, bleached to death by an unforgiving sun. And now, mysteriously, it hosts the largest remnant of the Empire. Her remnant, as a matter of fact. A military faction she thought she controlled. But her control was an illusion. She was just another puppet dancing on the strings of Gellius Rax. A supposed war hero who came to serve the Empire at the urging of Palpatine himself. None of it makes sense. Questions layer atop questions, and no answers are forthcoming. Why here? Why this place? It seems that Rax himself comes from this world. But why return? Jakku is no prize. It has few exports of note. Kesium and Bezerite have some value to the Empire, but only barely. Better resources exist, and they exist on worlds far livelier than this one. Why make an attack on Chandrila only to abandon the galaxy and come here? Why leave Sloane dangling on the hook? Why do any of it? What is Rax's game? He has one. That much is clear. He will tell her. One day soon, she will make him tell her. At the end of a blaster, a blade, or her own choking hands. But first, they must get to him. Which is why they're here, right now, on this rolling cart. A cart pulled by men unclothed except for the skirts of threaded leather hanging from their waists. Their chests, backs, arms, and shorn scalps are naked, painted with streaks of greasy red dust. Their mouths are closed with metal hooks. A hook in the top lip, a hook in the bottom, the two tugged together with a cinching knot. They can only murmur and mumble. They are servants and slaves. Ardent operators and faithful lunatics giving their lives over to their mad desert mistress. Next to her, Brenton grunts and growls as he shifts. "I told you," she says to him. "Practice your breathing. Relax your limbs. A deep breath in, a deep breath out. Oxygenate your blood." Since leaving Ganthal, Sloane has lived her life on starships. In her earliest days, she flew patrols and TIE fighters and shuttles. And her very first job was as a signal hawk on an asteroid monitoring station in the Anoat sector. Those roles did not allow her the luxury of getting up and moving around easily. And so she learned ways to remain comfortable, even in contortion. "That only helps so much," he snaps. And she detects a surge of anger. He hates her, she believes. Though he won't say as much. It stands to reason. His own wife, a rebel pilot, is the one who gave her the grievous wound he helped her to heal in the first place. She represents something he despises. The autocratic rule of a mad galaxy. He prefers that madness. The madness of rebellion. So be it. This alliance is built on anger and hatred. And that hatred is the glue that fixes Brenton to Sloane. The cart stops short. Hard enough that she almost loses her balance, which would mean pitching forward and smashing her face on the stone fiber boards. Next to her, she hears Brenton do exactly that. He oofs
as his head thuds against the floor of the cart.
Footsteps all around them. Hands grab at her face, tugging the blindfold off. Hers is stubborn and fails to easily fall away, and she feels the cold metal of a crooked blade against her temple. Thankfully, the blade faces away, and with a quick pull, the cloth is cut and falls. It takes her vision a moment to adjust. A massive impasse awaits. The cavern ends in a gargantuan, bulb-shaped chamber, its walls shot through with other smooth-walled tunnels. Tunnels that are too high up for this cart to easily reach. Next to her, she spies Brenton, his face and neck scrubby with beard, his forehead smudged with filth. He gasps as the slaves lift him up, rocking him back on his knees. They cut his blindfold free, too. Red-streaked, dust-caked faces regard them with wide eyes. Hook-bound mouths murmur and hum. The servants perform one more action, cutting through the ropes that bind their wrists, before scampering off like animals. They clamber up the rocks, long fingernails mooring in the cracks. They pull themselves into the tunnels and scurry away. Sloane and Brenton are alone. He gives her a puzzled look.
Now what?
Those two words echo, echo, echo in the bell-shaped cavern.
I suppose we wait, she says.
They don't want us to follow, do they?
I'm strong, but not strong enough to climb up into those tunnels.
Still, maybe that's what these deviants expect.
They seem hardly human.
Sanity does not shine in their eyes.
No. What lingers there in their stares is a special kind of derangement.
The zeal of service. Of having given your body and your mind over to someone else.
Sloane does not add that climbing into those tunnels would be difficult. Her side hurts today. A dread deep ache from her injury. An injury that never really healed properly.
Sometimes she lifts her shirt just to look at it. The skin there is puckered, like the sealed, dry lips of a dead man.
Were she still in civilization, it would have healed over well with Bacta and Mend Gel treatments. But Jakku is not civilization, and so her wound healed poorly. Every day it hurts, the pain lurking far deeper than the skin.
Brenton stands and stretches.
He gingerly steps down off the cart, almost losing his footing.
Sometimes Sloane looks at him and sees how much he's been stripped down. Again, the planet has an abrasive. He's gone from being a gangly, unruly branch to something leaner. A spear. A splinter.
Though she hasn't seen a mirror in months, Sloane assumes it's happened to her, too. Times like this, she realizes nothing will ever be the same.
She'll never have her empire back. She'll never have her own starship.
I'm going to die on this planet.
That truth has settled into the well of her gut. That truth is a part of her now.
I don't think,
Brenton starts to say, but the sound of something coming through those tunnels cuts him off. It's a rasping sound. Something sliding along sand-swept stone. It's her. Their mistress.
The hut's face appears at the topmost chamber. Bruised dark with red striations, the slug's face is not fat and thick as those of many huts, but narrower, like a slimy arrowhead. The mouth is wide, practically bisecting its whole head. The maw opens, and a long, lash-like tongue licks the air, tasting it. The hut hisses. She blinks her one eye. The other is roomy, the skin around it pocked and pitted with flecks of embedded metal, like a moon with glittering debris caught in its orbit. The slug begins to slither. Up out of the chamber she comes, long arms pulling herself down from tunnel to tunnel. Sloane has met other huts. Jabba, for instance, was a fat, blubbery stump, whose short tail was the most dexterous part of his corpulent body. A worm, a slug, a grub. This hut is longer, leaner. Not like a slug at all, but like a serpent. The hut slithers and wriggles down toward the ground. Sloane sees that behind the thing's head are a series of bulbous nodules and tumor-like protuberances. They hang bound together with filthy red ribbon, a strange accessory serving as an emblem of the creature's curious vanity. As the hut nears the bottom of the hollow cavity, once more her servants emerge from the various tunnels and chambers. They meet the beast at the bottom, thrusting the palms of their hands upward, catching her as she eases forward. Their hands form her stage, their feet her vehicle. Dozens of her slaves now make up a roving dais. They hum and sing gibberish as they draw her forward. Their gibberish dissolves into a single word.
Nima! Nima!
They haul her forward, this long-tailed worm. It is Nima who will help them. It is Nima who will open the way to find Rax. On this world, Rax is a ghost. Nobody knows him. Nobody's heard of him. Sloane and Brenton went to every ramshackle shanty town they could find. From Cratertown to Blowback, to hovels in the desert. They visited with Tito's hiding in their trapdoor tunnel systems. They asked questions of Blarina traders, of Kesium gas miners, of black market merchants. Rax was a non-entity. Then, someone said something. A bartender back in Cratertown, one of the first people they'd met on this world. He said for them to be careful, that someone had been stealing children. The Empire needs children. Wasn't that what Rax told her? She asked the bartender.
Where? Why?
He said he didn't know. But they'd been taken by thugs belonging to Nima the Hutt. Most taken from small villages and from the makeshift orphanages run by the Anchorites.
That's where most of the kids are kept. Nobody wants children running underfoot when you have a heavy-gauge blast drill blowing chunks of canyon wall apart. So they dump them there, with the Anchorites and their nurse women.
The bartender added,
I would have never let my kids go there.
The thought hit her. If Rax had been a child here, what if he was there? An orphan left behind for the Anchorites. That's when she found the trail. And it began with a man named Anchorite Kolob. He was a wretched old monk, carved by wind and sand, and worst of all by time. She found him kneeling in a mud daub hut, with a bent metal roof. He was praying. When she demanded he help them, he did so willingly. But he also said the man she seeks is not a man named Gallius Rax. Rax is a lie. A false identity, he explained.
Gally, what's the boy?
Kolob said, his voice shaking. He said to her that Gally was always a rebellious one. Always running off and chasing stories. Then one day, something truly changed in him. He became defiant. He led the other children astray. They began disappearing. And one day, Gally disappeared too.
Now the child has returned, and he is a child no longer.
The Anchorite tried then to sermonize to them. Some nonsense parable about seeds growing in dead ground, but she cut him off and asked,
Where did he go when he used to disappear?
the Valley of the Eremite, near a rock formation called the Plaintive Hand. That was where he could be found, the stories say. He wouldn't let anyone get close. He had traps. He had children protecting it. He had trained beasts to guard it. It wasn't far from the orphanage.
It's not far from here? Brenton asked.
It's quite far from here. This orphanage is not that one.
The old man's eyes fell into a dead, faraway gaze.
That one burned down.
Brenton said. Let me guess. That was the last you saw of Galley?
It was. It was.
Do you know what's there now? Sloane asked.
Nothing as far as I know. Just the valley, the hand, and the desolation that this world knows so well. But I know this. Now that Galley is back, he has returned to the Plaintive Hand. We've seen ships, and none may go that way, for that way is protected.
Protected by whom? She asked.
By Nima the Hunt.
They needed more information. At first she assumed who better to ask than the troopers and officers who now occupied this world. Together she and Brenton watched them and waited. But it soon became apparent that this was not the Empire she knew and loved. These men and women were undisciplined. Their armor was filthy and in disrepair. Their weapons were crusted with the grit of this planet. Many troopers failed to wear their helmets. The officers looked ragged and run down. And yet they were paranoid. They were brutal, abusing villagers, stealing food and water, lording over the small towns like emboldened bullies. Worst and most important, they were believers in what Rax had done here. They carried his banners. They gathered around and told stories of the man. They have to buy all the way in, Brenton said. This isn't a military anymore. It's a militia. Any sign of doubt will be beaten out of them, I wager. And such bold bravado is the only way to justify following the Empire to this place.
Easier to lie to yourself that this is what's best than admit you've become part of something terrible? She asked.
Maybe.
Then we need an unbeliever.
She described the unbeliever simply. Someone who did not want to be here on Jakku. Someone who was swept along and was now caught in the machine and unable to climb out. Someone who was a loyal soldier, but not a sycophant. Brenton, with his technical skills, helped Sloane rig up a crude listening device. With it, they were able to capture bits of radio transmissions and conversations between Imperials. Then one day, they heard a trooper, ID number RK242, telling his superior officer, a sergeant named Rylon, that he wasn't sure what they were doing here anymore, and he wondered if there was any other work anywhere in the galaxy he could be doing.
I just don't want to be here anymore,
RK-242 told Rylon. For that transgression, his fellow troopers, led by Rylon, dragged him out into the desert, stripped off his armor, and beat him bloody. Pieces of his armor littered the ground around him like the fragments of a broken shell, and RK-242 curled up among them in a fetal ball.
That is not Imperial justice, she thought. No honor in that. Just brute force behavior. How swiftly order begins to disintegrate.
They did not kill RK-242. He remained alive, if broken. Days later, he was back on duty, limping around, his armor clicking and clattering as he trembled inside it. Sloane went to him, had a little talk at the end of a blaster. RK-242 was thankful to see her. The moment she introduced herself, he began blubbering gratitude, snot bubbling at his nose. saliva stringing together his blistered split lips. Sloane explained to him that this was all a plot against her. Whether that was true or not, it mattered little. She said that Rax had committed a coup and had stolen the Empire from her grip.
"He's going to destroy us all," she said.
RK-242, through gulps and sobs, agreed. And then she pumped him for information. Everything she could.
"What is in the valley? What is by the plaintive hand? What is Rax up to?"
The trooper told her everything he knew. Rax called this world a place of purification. The unforgiving planet of Jakku would test them, train them, and harden them to stone. The only way to defeat the New Republic, Rax said, was to be transformed into a greater force, a cruel army, an empire that could survive the unsurvivable. That, and RK-242, referred to the man now as Counselor Rax. Seems her target had taken a new title for himself. How coy. She explained to RK-242 that the only recourse was to remove Rax from power. Violently, if need be. The trooper nodded gamely. Sloane said she needed to know everything about Rax, about his habits, his role here, anything. But RK-242 couldn't tell her much. He said the Empire had established a base beyond the Goazon, beyond the sinking fields. And it was there that Rax was consolidating his power. Every day, the Builder droids added more to the fortress, he said. And daily, too, came deliveries of TIE fighters, AT-ATs, AT-STs, troop carriers, new troopers. New ships arrived in the sky. The Empire gathered its assets, its resources, and its people. All here, on the planet or just above it. But that still told her nothing she didn't already know. She asked him again about the plaintive hand. He said that what he heard is that some old weapons facility lies hidden in the sand. Something built by Palpatine, or put here even earlier by, well, who knows? He heard Rax takes trips there, alone. And that's all RK-242 knew. He swore.
He didn't even know if it was true, but he'd heard it. So can she help him? Can she rescue RK-242 from this purgatory?
She ignored him and asked Brenton.
A weapons facility? Could that be why they're here on Jakku?
Even still, that didn't add up. The Empire needed no new weapons. It built the greatest weapon in the history of the galaxy. Twice. It did not need new battle stations. It needed new leadership. But the Empire did love its war machine. And maybe what's out there is something far greater than the Death Star ever was. A desire to find it and to kill Rax arose in her like hot magma, churning up through the volcanic channel of her heart. Sloane thanked the trooper. She said she'd have an important role for him, and when the time came, she'd call on him.
"Get back into your armor," she said. "Say nothing of this meeting to anyone."
When he turned around to pick up his helmet, she shot him in the back of the head before he could put it on.
Brenton cried out. He said, "We could have helped him!"
She answered, "There was no help for him." Then she said they had to go there, to whatever this facility was at the end of the Valley of the Eremite. One problem. They couldn't take a ship because they'd be shot down. And going on land meant going through the Yi'ulong Canyons and beyond, into the maze-like caverns of Bagheerlak Geru. And that meant one thing. Dealing with Nima the Hutt. Nima the Hutt owns this part of Jakku, and her slime trail stretches much farther than this territory. Like Jabba on Tatooine or Durga on Ulmatra, her influence and her corruption has a long tail. She runs the black market, slaves, scavenge, Kesium, Bezerite.
She isn't just some fat slug ruler, though. She isn't Jabba with his palace or Durga with his yacht. It's not just gangster business as usual.